This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and joining me, as he is every single week, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I'm getting a little bit nervous. Why are you amassing this huge fleet of ships right on my borders?
Chris, it's not anything to be worried about. Just settle down. And in fact, maybe just turn around. Have a drink. You won't even know we're here.
All right. I don't know. It seems really suspicious to me. It reminds me of what we're going to talk about today, which is the Battle of the Omarion Nebula, which we see play out in the Dias cast. And that's when the Romulans and the Cardassians, the Obsidian Order and the Tal Shiar, got together to head over to the Gamma Quadrant to try to kill all the Founders.
Yeah, Chris, it's something that we really see get set up very well in the third season. In our Ready Room conversation that we had about the Defiant, there's actually some seeds planted in there about the Obsidian Order not wanting them to go into the Araya system. And so finding out that it was really where the Obsidian Order had their fleet being amassed, that they were going to use to go and find the Founder's homeworld and destroy it with the help of the Tal Shiar.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what spurred the decision to talk about this today. Now, this episode of The Orb will actually drop before that Ready Room, but we were talking about Defiant. And I remember one comment that I made in the Ready Room, because I was just thinking off the top of my head as the discussion was going on. If Thomas Riker had succeeded in going to the Araya system and destroying those shipyards, could it have averted the Dominion War? But of course, it's more complex than that, right? There was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes leading up to the invasion, the Battle of the Omarion Nebula, skirmishes that had happened prior to that, things that happened after, and then the fact that in the Dias cast, we find out that Colonel Lovok, the Romulan leader, had actually been replaced by a changeling and that it was a trap in the first place.
It's a trap! In fact, Chris,
exactly.
I think that you need to put that sound effect in this episode because we're going to say, it's a trap! A lot.
I think you just created the sound effect that we will use in all future shows, Matthew.
Oh, gosh. You know, and that is one of the things that I really loved about the depth of what happens here is finding out that the Founders have placed all of these operatives in the different areas of the Alpha Quadrant. I mean, we already knew there was one in Starfleet. We saw that in Paradise Lost. They've obviously got one probably in the Romulan Empire, the Klingon Empire, and the Cardassian Empire. So they're all over the place. They didn't create this opportunity. They just found out that Tane had this idea with the Obsidian Order, and they did everything they could to push it forward and move it forward and get it to happen so they could use it for their ends, which is probably one of the scariest things we find out in, I think, all of Star Trek, is it's just watching the way that the Founders work.
Right, yeah, because that is a key point here. So let's set this up to set up the rest of our discussion, what we're talking about here. So first of all, what is the Omarion Nebula? So this is a gas cloud in the Gamma Quadrant, and inside this gas cloud, there's a rogue planet. That's the home of the Founders, and they made that their home about 10,000 years before the events that we're seeing in Deep Space Nine, and it's from this planet that they sent out the 100 baby changelings, of which Odo is one, to explore the galaxy. And in the search part two, that's where we find out about the planet and the Omarion Nebula, because Odo has this urge to go back and find his people. Now, the battle of the Omarion Nebula is what we see in the Dias cast. This is when the combined Romulan-Cardassian fleet goes through the wormhole and goes to this planet, and they start bombarding it. But of course, they are ambushed by 150 Jem'Hadar ships, because, as I just mentioned, Colonel Lovak was a changeling and had set it all up. So they had an inside man. So that's what we're talking about here with the Omarion Nebula and the Battle of the Omarion Nebula. Now, talking about what you were saying, Matthew, before that, the fact that the Founders are watching what's going on and they're finding opportunities to insert themselves into other political situations to really use their enemies to do their own bidding, to kind of do themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, taking the intentions of your enemy and using it against them, you know, using the best and the worst of your enemy to destroy them from within. It's just so smart. You know, this kind of reminded me, Chris, have you ever seen, and I've only seen a few episodes, but there's that show, The Americans, about the couple who is actually a Russian, they're Russian spies. But they live as normal Americans in a normal suburban town, and they're trying to, you know, find out information. And it's during the Cold War, and it's just so interesting because we see that's what the Founders are doing. They've sent these operatives. They live as everyday people in the different places that they're in. Nobody has any idea who they are, and yet they're actively working against the government and the people that they live with every single day. And they have no qualms about it. I think that's just so interesting. I mean, Lovak has no loyalty. He's earned no love for any of the people, any of the Cardassians or the Romulans that he's been with for, you know, who knows, however many years, which is just very interesting to see him and the difference between somebody like Odo, who kind of grew up with the solids, was found by the solids, nurtured by them, and is, in some ways, I mean, even though he has this longing to go home, feels more comfortable with the solids. So I just thought that was an interesting thing to see kind of play out as this whole battle is going on, these two different, completely different type of changelings. I mean, they're both changelings, but they look at things completely differently.
Exactly, yeah. Well, let's talk about, kind of roll back here. You mentioned earlier that this wasn't the Founders' plan. So when you think about this storyline, sometimes you may remember it as Lovak being a changeling, and Lovak went there and he got everything rolling, and, you know, he can be a Romulan, a changeling disguised as a Romulan military leader, and tell people, this is what we should do. Let's get this great plan to go and find the Founders and just lead them straight into the trap. But as we've talked about, that's not what happened. It was actually Tane's plan, and then they replaced Lovak to kind of facilitate it going through. So from the side of the Alpha Beta powers, which, of course, when we get to the full-on war, we call them the Alpha Beta powers because you've got the Klingons in there as well, who are actually from the Beta Quadrant. But when you talk about the Cardassians and the Romulans here, I want to think about what's going through the minds of the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order that led them to support this action. So what leads Tane to come up with the action? What leads everyone else to support it and decide that this is a great idea, that we're going to build this massive fleet? And also another thing that, another angle that we didn't talk about before the show here, is Starfleet is happy to let them go through the wormhole and try to destroy the Founders. You know, Starfleet Command's going to sit back like, okay, just, it wasn't cool of you guys to decloak right on top of the station with this massive fleet, but we're going to pretend like we didn't see it happen. We're going to let you go.
Which is really interesting because, Chris, did you notice, and this is a complete aside, which I thought was hilarious, but that the admiral that Sisko talks to in this episode is also the CNC of Starfleet from Star Trek VI. He's the one who tells Kirk that the Klingons would think twice about firing on the Enterprise under his command. Uh-huh. Very same guy.
That guy.
He gets around.
He's up to something.
Yeah. Like a
maybe he's
record.
A changeling. That's why he looks
thinking.
The same after yeah. 100 years.
Which yeah. actually would have been a really cool storyline, I think.
It would, actually,
like,
right?
If why didn't you think in, about so. That? Because they had the exact same guy. But I thought that was really interesting because, yeah, Starfleet has no problems with doing that. But two, doesn't this sound like a plan that Section 31 would have done everything they could have to support as well?
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely. So, rolling back, I hijacked my own question there by adding another question onto the end of it. So going back to the part about why the Cardassians and the Romulans would be supporting this, if we think about a couple of skirmishes, so the Battle of the Omorion Nebula was the first major engagement between the Dominion and the Alpha Beta powers. But before that, at the end of season two in the Jem'Hadar, there's a Jem'Hadar offensive and they destroy the colony on New Bajor, which was in the Gamma Quadrant. And we also saw the run on the Odyssey where they blew up the Galaxy-class Odyssey. So there have been a few little skirmishes, a few things to make people nervous at this point. So do you just see the Cardassians and the Romulans as being on the sidelines watching that stuff happen and thinking about, like, maybe they're going to come after us, we need to do something? Or is there more of an ulterior motive here to try to pit the Federation against the Dominion in some way? Because even if they destroy the Founder's homeworld, there's still going to be all these Jem'Hadar around everywhere.
Yeah, which is interesting because they believe that the Jem'Hadar will easily be wiped out because they won't have
when
access to the white anymore. And
white, yeah.
They feel like that in 4 or 5 days, they'll basically die because they don't have access to it anymore.
Isn't that a bad plan, though? Because, I mean, they produce Ketracel White, but you've got Jem'Hadar all over the Gamma Quadrant, as I understand it, because the Dominion seems to be quite vast. Destroying this one world, that's not where they're actually making the Ketracel White. And the Vorta are the one who actually give the...
Yeah, that's the part that I didn't feel like was well thought out, because they're not destroying the Vorta. Now,
do we know much about the Vorta at this point, though?
We don't.
At least at the time that Tane would have been formulating his plan.
We don't know a lot about them. We also don't understand, I think, exactly the relationship between all of them and how mm-hmm. exactly they react. You know, if they don't have their gods to tell them what to do, if their gods are gone, there is every, you know, idea that especially the Jem'Hadar might even just kill themselves because they mm-hmm. see no reason for living, because their whole reason for living is the defending of the Dominion, and victory brings life. Without their gods to tell them what them brings victory, would they even want to exist? So there's a lot of questions that go around this. Now, as to what I think the Romulans and the Cardassians are thinking they're going to get out of this, I think both the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order want to get rid of a enemy the easiest, quickest way possible. And they believe this is the way to do it. When you look at it on paper, I mean, it looks like a pretty good plan. You know, we're going to go sneak up on their doorstep, decloak, and destroy their homeworld. Because how could they be expecting it?
It's almost like they're Zindi.
Yeah, exactly. Right? There you go. It is, I mean, it doesn't, it doesn't take a lot for me to understand, you know, why somebody like Tane or the Obsidian Order or the Tal Shiar would think like this, because I honestly feel that this is exactly how Section 31 thinks about this. And they almost, I think, they're thinking, man, why didn't we come up with this plan? Because it's not too bad. Of course, until they all get blown up and never come back.
It's like you say, on paper, it sounds like maybe a good idea and it might be easy to carry out this whole fleet of starships bombarding one planet. But at the same time, I mean, they're putting a lot of resources and a lot of faith into a plan that's being developed without a lot of intelligence behind it, intelligence gathering. Like, they don't have enough knowledge, like you said, about how the Dominion is structured and how the different people, because again, they're not really aware yet of the Vorta and their role. So they know there are Jem'Hadar warriors. They know there are these changelings. There's a very important link there that they don't know much about at all. And so they actually create a plan that I think really wouldn't work in the first place. And then, of course, they all get wiped out.
Yeah, it's really interesting to kind of think through, you know, what in the world it is they are thinking. And I really like that with this plan, it does seem like something that would be a great idea from their standpoint. And it makes me wonder just how much the founders and how they kind of egg on the process, you know, and maybe even feeding them false data at that point as well.
Yeah, which they could easily do.
And so I think that's the other thing that we have to remember here. You know, Tane comes up with the idea. The founders find out about it and become involved with the, you know, the pushing forward of this plan. And so what better way to do that than send them all the data to make them feel like this is an easy win?
Right.
And
right.
What I thought was really interesting too. So the 120 Jem'Hadar ships, Chris,
150
Jem'Hadar ships there. Doesn't seem like a lot to me after I've seen some of the Deep Space Nine battles, you know, where there's thousands of ships. It seems like it's kind of a small armada that they send in as well. I mean, this is not a huge armada of Tal Shiar and Obsidian Order ships, you know, if they're outmatched that badly.
Well, I don't think they were expecting any resistance.
Well, that's
they thought,
true.
Yeah. This is going to be a sneak attack because they're traveling at warp 6, I think it is, in that episode. And Garrick is making fun of the Romulans. Like, isn't that a little bit slow? And he says that, and this is, I think it's the changeling Colonel Lovak who says it, if I remember correctly, that, well, if we travel any faster, they might detect us even through the cloak. But they are thinking they're going to be able to sneak over because, again, the planet is inside a nebula, inside a gas cloud. And so once they're inside, it's not like people are going to be just scanning. And they're expecting, I'm sure their intelligence reports, which could have been falsified, as you mentioned, are telling them like there are no defenses to this planet because they think it's hidden. So they probably thought they were going to sneak in and just hit this. But at the same time, and if there's, and I don't want to really talk about the Dias cast itself today. We'll do an episode on that some other point. But since you mentioned the number of ships and the battle, when the Defiant comes in, they're just psh. Those Jem'Hadar ships are like one shot and they're gone.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It makes you feel like all those warbirds and the Cardassian cruisers were really weak.
Well, it does. And maybe they had, you know, with the cloaking devices they had installed, especially on the Cardassian ships, and who knows with how that affects everything else. And they're not really expecting, like you said, to have to be in a big battle. They're just expecting to be able to go in and blow a whole planet up, you know, and that's really their only goal. So I think that is really interesting. And what I love, you know, just kind of the idea of this is it really does, I mean, it touches on the whole idea of like preemptive strikes, you know, do you go with that? And then there is a big difference, I think, sometimes when we start talking about how this really applies to real life. Because we know that the founders later are going to be the ones who created this huge war in the Alpha Quadrant. And this wasn't the worst idea ever, honestly. If you could have taken them out, most of them out, would you do it? The morality of basically trying to commit genocide, though, against entire people who haven't attacked you yet, though, is no morality for that. That's amoral. Mm-hmm.
But in this case, they have attacked. I mean, they wiped out the colony on Bajor.
That's true.
Which initiated what we would basically call a cold war between the Dominion mm-hmm. and the Federation at that point, even though Bajor is not a Federation member, but it's protectorate at that point. And they destroyed a galaxy-class starship.
Yeah, this is true.
So they have... The Dominion's hands are not clean.
No,
a preemptive strike.
Yeah, but they also haven't declared full-on war with them.
Which is why this all feels like a lot of Cold War machination to me. It's like Cold War machinations with, especially if we think of the Romulans or the Cardassians as being on that other side. Because the Romulans and the Federation are basically in a Cold War and have been, you know, for a century or more.
Well, and it'll take the Dominion War for them to stop being in that kind of position, mm-hmm. which is very interesting and kind of leads to a little bit of a different understanding between the two.
Yeah. So speaking of preemptive strikes, we can look at, it feels like on the surface, it feels like this is a preemptive strike by the Cardassians and the Romulans against the Founders. But actually, I would say it's a preemptive strike by the Dominion against the Cardassians and the Romulans, because once they found out about the plan and they sent one of their people in to replace Lovak, they're dragging the Romulans and the Cardassians to this nebula so they can ambush them and destroy the intelligence agencies, organizations of these two powers. So I really see it as a preemptive strike on the side of the Founders. What do you see in everything that's happened up to this point that would leave the Founders to feel like they need to set that trap?
I think that their goal is the exact same as the Tal Shiar's, and I think it's the exact same as sitting orders here. We want to take our enemy and we want to make them as weak as possible. And I think that the Founders, in a lot of ways, have the idea that they are going to be going after, most likely sometime in the Alpha Quadrant, all of these powers. What's the best way to do that? Well, we will weaken them as much as possible. And I think it's a brilliant plan, because they take out, as Loak says at the very end, we've taken out two of the most ruthless, underhanded organizations in the Alpha Quadrant, and the only powers left now are the Klingons and the Federation.
Don't forget about the Ferengi.
Well, that's true. I mean, those Ferengi Marauders and their whips. Oh yeah. My goodness.
And the Paklids too.
Yes, and their empire.
But yeah, so they're taking out, like, if you're looking at the Alpha Quadrant and the Beta Quadrant, you're seeing Federation, Romulans, Cardassians, Klingons. Right. That's basically, those are the four that you would be fearful of as putting up a fight against you.
Well, and I love that at the very end, he even says, look, it's really not going to be that big of a deal for the Federation and the Klingons much longer. And I think mm-hmm. that's probably one of the scariest things that we hear at the end of this massacre that happens in the nebula. It is not going to be a good thing.
So a question here, though, do you feel like they actually crippled the ability of the Romulans and the Cardassians to fight, to defend themselves and to take the fight to the Jem'Hadar? Or is it more like a campaign of fear? Like, look, we massacred your entire fleet and destroyed the Tal Shiar and the Obsidian Order, so you should be fearful of this. Because, again, this was a secret operation, and this fleet was built for this purpose. So the Romulans and the Cardassians, they still have all their ships that they had before this fleet was built, and they still have their normal militaries, in place.
I think that they really do hurt the effectiveness of the Cardassians and the Romulans. These are two peoples who rely heavily on their intelligence communities. Mm-hmm. And I think the Tal Shiar has a huge presence, obviously, with the Romulans and in the Empire. And it's kept them, you know, safe for a long time, their intelligence network. And with having it obliterated really weakens the Romulans. And the same thing for the Cardassians. I mean, the Obsidian Order is something that is a part of their governmental system, as we kind of talked about on the Ready Room, Chris, where we talked about Defiant. The Obsidian Order and the military are supposed to report to the civilian government there. So it's supposed to work kind of like as a triangle. And by taking one of those pieces out, you really are hurting those two great big powers in the Alpha Quadrant.
Well, especially in the case of the Cardassians, one of the side effects of this battle is that once the Obsidian Order had collapsed, the Cardassian underground was able to go in and seize power because there was a power vacuum without the Obsidian Order there. I feel kind of like the Cardassian governmental structure relied more on the Obsidian Order than the Romulan governmental structure relied on the Tal Shiar.
Yeah, it's a possibility. And I think that either way, it has a huge impact on just I think it has a huge impact on what the Alpha Quadrant looks like. And it destabilizes those places enough, and especially, I think, the Cardassians, because they're about to be in a war with the Klingons. And the Founders have do that on purpose as well. And it really weakens the Cardassians to the point where the Cardassians the greatness of Gul Dukat's mind think they need some help, and they go to the Dominion for help. So the Founders do a great job of just really working it in the Alpha Quadrant.
Did you feel like Tane kind of came up short in this operation in terms of him being the great strategic mind and leader of the Order that we have come to think of him as from other stories where we hear about him or see him?
I think he was played. And I think that he had gotten a little bit too arrogant at this point.
Yeah, he was overconfident.
Exactly. He was overconfident. And as we know from Star Wars, you should be careful, or overconfidence becomes your weakness, and just like the Emperor. And Tane definitely had that problem. And I love that they kind of play with that in Star Trek and with mm-hmm. Tane here, because it's a, I don't know, I really liked it. I think that the way that they set him up and then have him fall was kind of perfect. You know, pride goes before mm-hmm. the fall. And it was great to watch his story. Well, think, at least at this point, we kind of think it comes to an end. So,
mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about one last aspect of this to kind of pull it all together and how it is heating things up, because we had the skirmishes prior to this. Then we have this battle, which was orchestrated. And then eventually we get to the actual Dominion War. So how do you see this battle, the Battle of the Omorian Nebula, playing into the full-scale war that follows?
Oh, goodness. I think this does its job in helping create a completely destabilized Alpha Quadrant. So by the time mm-hmm. we get to the war, this quadrant has already had a lot of things hit it. You know, they've already hit the Romulans. They've hit the Cardassians. They'll have hit the Klingons by the time this is over, as well as the Federation a little bit, too. And everybody will have been just kind of in an upheaval. And
everyone is on edge. Exactly. All the time.
And it is on edge for so long. So I love that it works together really beautifully. And that they just keep playing people. They keep playing those fears. They understand how to play the fears, I think. They play a great psychological game.
Yeah.
Which I really like. And it's...
That's what the founders are good at, yeah. Right? They play a great psychological game.
And it's...
They really do.
Yeah, what I think is great about it is that it's scary. You know, like, this is one of the scariest things I've ever seen a villain do. So... I really enjoy it. I think it's a really well done job on the part of the writers, and to really be crafting a story that has so many threads through it. And this is just one stepping stone, but it's quite a large stepping stone in the threat of the Dominion. It gets a little thrown out of whack a little bit with Worf coming on, but they are even able to use that with the Klingons and the Cardassians going to war and all that. So,
yeah,
this is great.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see if Worf had not come on and they had kept this storyline going straight through, where it would have led.
Yeah, it does seem like it would have kind of quickly ended up more quickly into a war. And then maybe, you know, it might not have lasted all the way till the seventh season. But
I can't imagine it without the Klingons being such a part of it. And I can't imagine the Klingons being such a part of it without Worf being on the show.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, in the end, I think it worked out for the best. And I was always a big fan of the way that they were able to make things work. I think they did a great job. So they should really be commended, if you ask me, for the work that they did about getting thrown a loop, being able to pull that loop back into the storytelling and continue on with, I think, a good arc, a great arc, and you really end up with some great character moments. And man, I can't imagine Deep Space Nine at this point without having Worf, because he was fantastic.
Well, I will also say about the Battle of the Omarion Nebula that it's amazing how early on in the season the seeds of the Dominion War were planted, and the way that they were planted, and the real meat of the action in the die is cast. This actual battle that we're focusing on today happens at the end of the episode as well. You know, most of the episode is them traveling there, and then the actual battle happens at the end. But I do see it as really pivotal, because it's also the point where, if we look at this as being sort of a Cold War between the Dominion and the Federation up to this point, this is a point where you cannot ignore that anymore.
You can't think that...
Well, for the next few decades, we're just going to have this kind of standoff, but no one's really going to do anything. You know, I mean, we grew up during the Cold War in real life. And, you know, I certainly grew up at school, you know, practicing for, you know, we have fallout shelters all over town. Yep. They're marked. But at the same time, you kind of felt like it's going to be okay, right? Like, it's a standoff, but no one's actually going to pull the trigger, because no one wants to have that full-scale war. And maybe here it sort of felt like that too, especially because it's the other side of the galaxy and you've just got this wormhole connecting you, but there's a distance and a separation. But after this battle, the Federation especially would look at this, and especially the Cardassians and the Romulans, because they had so many losses, they would know that this is going to lead to somewhere bad, and we're going to have to really start planning for an actual war.
Yeah.
So there we go. Very specialized topic today, the Battle of the Omarion Nebula. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And like, we were so busy, we didn't eat like all day. I had a Red Bull around 5 o'clock, right before the parsecs. I could feel my teeth, like, tingling.
Yeah, yeah.
It was weird.
Earl Grey.
He was robbing the bokle, as they say it in Klingon, as a Klingon word I just made up, just so you know.
I think we could tell.
The Orb.
What I also liked, too, was that Nog said, put that in there, too, to Jake, and let people decide. And that just summed up DS9 for me, because DS9 is... You know, we're not going to tell you for sure he's a bad captain, even though obviously I think most people would agree that he was.
To the journey!
Oh yeah, B'Elanna's reading romantic fanfic.
Not everything is fanfic, okay?
This could be.
a legitimate author with a legitimate publisher.
No, this is Klingon Harlequin. You know it is.
Warp 5.
The Orions, there's something really complex going on within their society, and there's a long-term struggle where the women have flipped the table on the men. And how does that all play out? And it's something where I wish Enterprise had gone for 7 seasons and they could have continued to revisit this and we'd find out more and more.
The Ready Room.
You know, people have seen that image. That image in particular, just that still of her with the Desilu logo over it, is really iconic. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what I discovered is it's not a still. It's probably 26 different stills.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
A number of scenes from especially the end of Into Darkness are sort of lifted and adapted from Wrath of Khan to be used in this story.
Lifted and Google translated into this version.
Literary Treks.
We all know Troy gets all the men that come on, all the envoys, actually. You notice that she really likes these bad boy envoy men, you know?
She does.
Continuing mission.
How is Spock changing? How is he changed from the moment he met Captain Kirk from the non-mirror universe? What is his ultimate goal?
Axanar, the official podcast.
So basically, you've got this souped-up computer with this lens on the front of it. And because the resolution has increased so much with these cameras, the amount of data coming out of that camera is enormous.
And join us in welcoming aboard Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
I'm really, really glad that you mentioned Parliament Funkadelic. I could not watch this at all without thinking about George Clinton.
Yeah, so, just every time he talks about going to Parliament, I'm like, yeah.
I wouldn't want to go?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. We're all over the place. You can get our podcasts pretty much everywhere. If you're an iTunes user, though, we would love for you to subscribe. If you don't subscribe to The Orb in iTunes, please head over and hit that subscribe button because it really helps us out. It helps us rise up in iTunes. That's where most people get their podcasts. That's what the statistics show. But we want you to get our shows everywhere that you are as well. That's why we're in Stitcher and on TuneIn, on SoundCloud, we're in the Microsoft directories, we're all over the place. Just search for Trek.fm and the name of the show you want to listen to, and you'll find us there. If you are in iTunes or on Stitcher, be sure to leave us a review if you haven't already. We love to hear what you think about the show, and that also helps other Deep Space Nine fans find the Orb as they're looking around in those places. Another way you can help us out, if you'd like the Orb to keep coming to you every single week, is to head over to Patreon. Patreon.com/TrekFM. That's Patreon.com/TrekFM is where we're putting some content these days. It's a lot like Kickstarter, but instead of an individual project, it's a way for you to support the creatives that you love on a monthly basis. So you can set any amount that you would like to contribute recurring each month. We have our goals set up so you can see what we're trying to find at the moment. And we also have milestone donation levels set up, along with all the great perks that we have to give you in exchange for your support. So head over there, patreon.com/TrekFM, and check those out. And we really, really do appreciate any support that you can give us there. And so you can help Matthew and me keep the Orb coming to you every single week. So Matthew, when you're not, you know, planning your next great invasion of some neighbors that you're, you know, just not that fond of, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with you, where we talk about books and comics of Star Trek. And then, of course, you can find me at my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Chris, when you're not using your founder's powers for nefarious means, where can we find you?
Yeah, it's really handy. I love being able to change shape, by the way.
I bet. It does seem like it would be a pretty good deal. So let's try to use that power for good, okay?
Okay, I'll try to use it for good. I'll keep that in mind. Now, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/CBrianJones. And I have my website at cbrianjones.com. And then, Matthew, in addition to doing Literary Treks with you, did you know I do a lot of other shows on the network?
I have heard that, Chris.
Some people say I do too many shows because I also do Matterstream, Continuing Mission, Warp 5, Hyperchannel, The Ready Room, and I co-host the official podcast of Star Trek Axanar with Axanar creator Alec Peters. So if you want to hear more of my ramblings about Star Trek, you can do that in all those places. Before we let you go, we would like to remind you about one more way that you can help us out, and that is by supporting our sponsor, Audible.com. Audible is a great way to support the network because you get great audiobooks in exchange. As a member of Audible, you'll get credits each month and great prices on the best audiobooks around. I've been an Audible user for 14 years myself. I have so many audiobooks and I highly recommend it. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm to get that free audiobook. Choose whatever you want. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you will get to keep that audiobook. But when you try Audible, we'll get a little cut from them that really does help us also keep The Orb and all of our other shows coming to you every single week. So we thank you for supporting them, and we thank Audible for supporting The Orb and the network.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into The Orb.